Hello, everyone, and welcome to Managed Healthcare Executives' monthly What's on Your Mind podcast. In this podcast series, editors will check in with members of the Managed Healthcare Executive Editorial Advisory Board and ask them what's on their mind. Some of these topics will include the challenges they and their organizations are facing, the uphill battles, and the success stories, the short horizon, and the longer game. We're going to pick their brains to give our listeners valuable information and insight into healthcare today. A pandemic is not on anybody's wish list. But the one that COVID-19 has wrought has ushered in some constructive changes to U.S. healthcare that previously has been more talked about than done, said Rodrigo Cerda, Senior Vice President of Health Services and Chief Medical Officer at Independence Blue Cross in Philadelphia. Cerda is this month's guest on the What's on Your Mind podcast, and in this episode, he talks with managing editor Peter Werwein about another pandemic silver lining, the recognition of the significance of behavioral health. Cerda refers to it as whole person health and how it helps spur Independence to integrate coverage and management of behavioral health services into its other offerings.
So to begin this, what I hope is an informative true back and forth sort of conversation. It dawned on me recently that we're about a quarter of the way into the 21st century, which I found sort of staggering. I'm sort of still used to being in the 20th century. I'm showing my age. But I'm just wondering what's on your mind and what are you thinking about in sort of broad strokes as far as where things stand with U.S. healthcare? What are the 21st century problems and issues that you are thinking about, particularly as a relatively newly minted medical director of a major Blues plan?
It's a thought-provoking question, right? There's lots of directions you can take that. I think on the one hand, I think we always have to recognize that evolution and progress in healthcare happens over the course of many years. And so I don't think that now, just because we're 22 years into the 21st century, that we're all of a sudden going to make, immediate change, right? But I think one of the things that I think we have to reflect on, which takes us back to when we spoke a year ago, is that, COVID has, for better or for worse, been this huge disruptor in healthcare, right? I think maybe we were all relatively comfortable with our pace of change before, recognized that it wasn't ideal. And COVID just was a huge stressor to everybody, right? And we talked, I think, at the beginning of 2022 about, hey, we think this year is going to be the beginning of a return to normal. And I think for many of us, in some ways it is. I'm sure we're all doing more social things, wearing less masks, and hopefully vaccinated. For providers, the stress continues, right? COVID was a sort of long and prolonged crisis. And some of the aftershocks now, are financial as well, right? In that providers are having a lot of difficulties recruiting enough staff at all levels. Costs for our healthcare providers have gone up, and so they're in financial crunch, right? And so I think I do think about that a lot in terms of, on the one hand, you know, COVID is an opportunity. It always felt like it's an opportunity to think about how we could do things better. And it's forced us to do some things that we've been talking about for decades, like thinking about telemedicine or telemonitoring in a new way. And people have used it and found that it works well, right? So I think it's sort of an ability to use digital tools to access healthcare is really one of the positive things that we see. There's recognition of behavioral health or whole person health as a critical component of being successful in healthcare, right? And in some ways, that, you know, COVID highlighted that because a lot of people experienced all the stresses of that crisis, and it became more acceptable and normalized, right? And so I think that's fed strategies like independences, where we really do focus on whole person health, you know, and are doing a lot of efforts we can talk about on you know, improving access to behavioral health, making it more integrated. But, you know, you think about those stresses and providers, and that is an issue, right, when we think about access. And I worry, and I've probably always had a bias to worry about primary care a lot. I think it's pretty central in terms of achieving the, you know, cost, quality, experience, and equity that we look for as kind of outcomes as a society, and certainly as a payer and as our regulators in CMS. And we ask a lot of primary care, and primary care in some ways has borne the brunt, in particular thinking about the more independent primary care docs where you know, they can't weather the storm as well, right? Because thinking about the financial pressures and difficulty recruiting primary care docs, difficulty recruiting medical assistants, and the staff that it takes to truly do team-based primary care. So that is something that I think about a lot in terms of that we're thinking about as an institution of how should we be paying for primary care? How should we be supporting primary care in the model that we think about in the future and ensuring that our members get that best access? And then the final thing that, you know, is you know, I am thinking about a lot is getting back to that kind of triple aim approach. You know, there are some parts of our business where we have a clear value-based payment to us. Think about CMS, where we are on the hook for total cost and for quality and experience through STARS. I'd like to make sure that for our self-funded business, it gets to be more like that, right? And in the simplest terms, self-funded, or the classic version of self-funded, is a fee-for-service model where we get paid to administer the plan, but aren't, you know, financially accountable enough, I would say, for some of the outcomes. And so that's something that we're working on as well in terms of thinking that so that we can be and kind of really embrace the positive role that we can have as a health plan in our region.
So people have been talking about integrating physical and mental health for quite a while and whole person health, and it tumbles off the tongue fairly easily because it's been talked about so much. Could you give me sort of some ways you're trying to you're making that concrete, where you're actually bringing it into reality?
Yeah. So for us, the approach to whole person health is really runs the gamut of activities that we have. First of all, we are, you know, we used to have our behavioral health services outsourced, where it was we sort of ran it through a different organization. We've done the integration ourselves now that we now have responsibility for the network and care management and utilization management and all the classic functions, which enables us to, you know, not think about each of the, you know, mental health and physical health as separate things, and to really be thoughtful about the interaction of both of those things. And where, you know, you think about if you only take one piece of it, you might want to save money here, right? But, you know, the reality is that people don't behave that way. They are individuals that contain both the brain and the rest of the body.
When did this integration happen, or has it been sort of a gradual?
It's been ongoing, and we now we have the network and care management, and are starting utilization management shortly. And so this is this year that we've been doing that. The other things that we've...
I'm sorry. There's been some concern with the advent of telehealth for behavioral health, of overutilization, that the convenience, which is great, that that's equals access and people coming to the appointments, but that you might get people who, because it's... so convenient that there might be some overuse. Does that concern you?
I suppose it's a theoretical concern. I think the reality to date is that the problem is probably more under access than over access. There we know, and again, it's not universal. It's not equitable actually across the population. We know that there are some populations that tend to access less than others, right? You think, Black populations, Hispanic populations tend to access a bit less, and so it's not fully spread equally, right? But I think in general, we probably have more of a challenge to ensure that more of our members get more access to behavioral health services than the problem of people over accessing. We haven't seen that yet. Certainly we would look, we're always, trying to make sure that we are good stewards of the healthcare dollar. But I think it's, we're probably on the other side of the swinging pendulum, I guess. For us, it's interventions like thinking about integrated behavioral health in primary care or in other settings, and paying for that and helping our provider groups to implement it is part of that, saying, hey, we need to get more access. We need to get access in a place where our members and their patients are comfortable in getting it. And part of that is having it together. It needs to be more coordinated with the rest of healthcare, right? So it's more access, better quality of access, right? And part of what we've done with our partnership with Quartet, as well as a company that started really facilitating that connection between primary care and behavioral health, both in terms of getting, if they need to make a referral, making it to a high quality behavioral health provider that actually has availability, and then facilitating that communication. And they've added other features like, really adding to the capacity, right, with their acquisition of Innovatel. They bring more behavioral health capacity to the table as well, which is another limiter, that there just isn't enough. Like, you can facilitate the connection, but if there isn't enough capacity, behavioral health resources to make the connection to, you're not really going to solve the problem. And again, not the same across all groups, right? You think about, pediatric behavioral health services, for example, is an area that has particularly high needs. These are the kinds of things that we are worried about and focused on. We're taking really a comprehensive approach, right? Integrate the way we work, help our providers integrate physical and behavioral health, bring more resources to the table with Quartet, and we're looking at others as well. And we think that with that whole set of activities will lead to better outcomes, better experience for our members, and meeting a need that really hasn't been met historically.
One more question on mental health. I think that historically, there's been a problem with mental health providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, who are willing to see patients at the sort of payment that insurers make, and that a lot of the barrier to access is that there are very few providers who will who will see somebody for the insured rate. Is that observation of mine accurate in your opinion? And if it is, how are you dealing with that?
Yeah. I think there's truth in that observation. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And that's part of what I was getting at and saying that, you know, when your mandate is sort of within behavioral health only and it's to really contain costs, then, you know, that might be a good outcome. But when you think about a person holistically, you know, as we're doing now, getting that access is important. And we think there's a lot of value for that across the entire sort of journey of each member. So the reality is that some of the process of insourcing, it may be that in order to ensure levels of access, we're not going to win, let's say, on the unit cost basis. But we do want to make sure that we get a broader network of high quality providers into our into sort of more available to our members. And we want to think about value-based payment programs with those providers. And we want to think about the value of the services that they provide on that broader scale, right? So, you know, when you address somebody's behavioral health needs, you can also address some of the other ones, right? If you want to help a member address, you know, their diabetes and have better control of their blood sugars and all the potential complications from diabetes, you're going to have a really hard time doing that if you haven't addressed the fact that they are depressed or they're very anxious, right? And so we think that by addressing some of the behavioral health needs, we're going to get a sort of large knock-on effect of positive impact on our members' health.
Just one quick question, and then so when you say you're not going to make it on unit cost, does that mean that you've had to sort of raise the rates that you pay mental health providers in order to get a good network together?
Yeah, I feel like it's you always get on thin ice when you talk about rates of any providers and negotiations. But you know, I think I would just say that the point of insourcing was not focused on winning on unit costs for our behavioral health network, and that when we think about some of those trade offs, we acknowledge that part of what drove the lack of access is that there just weren't enough clinicians willing to accept the rates that they'd been getting, right? And so that's the reality, and we want to do that in an efficient way, right? We're not looking to, I don't think anybody can really afford to have medical cost inflation be greater than it has been, right, on a total basis. So we are trying to really balance that, ensuring we have access while also keeping healthcare affordable for our members.
Changing the subject to something you referenced in your opening remarks, if you will. You talked about the financial stress of providers and issues with labor shortages and so on and so forth. How does an insurer, a Blues plan like Independence, how does that affect you? Do you have providers just coming to you? Sorry to keep on going back to rates, but are they just coming to you asking, pleading that they have all these higher costs and therefore they need some adjustment? Or I'm just wondering how the stress on the providers manifests itself in terms of how you work with providers.
Yeah. You know, as a Blue plan and the largest, you know, plan in our region, and you know, a plan that has the, sort of this local presence here in Philadelphia and the surrounding areas. You know, we are a part of this community. We have an interest in making sure that our health healthcare provider network is strong, and that, you know, our members have that access, and we are part of this community too. So we don't want providers to fail. We want providers to be practicing sustainably, efficiently, certainly, but we don't want them to be going under. So we have had lots of conversations with our providers on how do we do this? How do we invest in our network in a way that's sustainable? We're not looking to be at a disadvantage to other payers, but the reality is that the finances have changed for our providers, and you know, we are having a lot of these conversations where providers are saying, "Hey, look, our costs are changing, and some of the assumptions that we may have made in prior years may be different." And so, we're trying to do this sustainably and as a member of the community. You know, so these are conversations that we have. Yeah.
You are in a market, Philadelphia, that has seen great consolidation the last few years, particularly with the growth of the Jefferson system and buying up lots of hospitals. And I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that consolidation on the provider side leads to higher prices. It's just buying power and bargaining power. So are you seeing those sorts of pressures in Philadelphia as a result of the consolidation of the provider systems here into really two big groups, Penn and Jefferson?
Yeah. You know, I think it's true that the easiest benefit to a provider system of consolidation is negotiating power, right? Then you don't need to change anything of how you work as a system in order to access that value lever as a provider. But I'm an optimist, right? I think that there is potential to work better as a system, to be more, to consolidate some resources, to make investments in things that allow sort of more proactive management of population health, that allow kind of service line approaches that are more centered around patients than around you know, the individual physician specialties, say. And there are examples of where, you know, health systems have managed to do that and have delivered more value. And you know, I know that Jefferson Health has new leadership, and Dr. Joe Caccione as their CEO. And part of the focus is to move, for example, to function more like a system, and to they've done some reorganization there. And you know, I think we're right there and ready to partner with systems like that to try to really capture that next level of value that you can get from consolidation. So I think it's true. On average, you know, it's the negotiating power, and it increases rates. But there is that potential. There have been some systems that have captured it, and I think we can do it, right? And that's what I would want to do with Jefferson, and, you know, with Penn and whatever other health systems we're working with.
I believe you have some programs whereby you're investing in some clinical innovation projects that would maybe get at some of this realization of value that you just referenced. Mm-hmm. Could you just describe that program and maybe fill us in on one sterling example?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the idea we started the clinical care innovation program pretty soon after arriving at Independence, and I think the thesis of it is that really changing how care is delivered is hard, and it requires that upfront investment in order to get that payoff down the road. And if that upfront investment is if it's too hard to do it, it takes too much time, too many resources, you're just never going to get over the hump and to the promised land on the other side. So the whole idea of this program is to just make it a little bit easier to get there. You sort of think about the, you know, I always think about the kind of, you know, catalyst, right? When you catalyze a reaction, you just make it a little bit easier for the reaction to happen to get to the other side. And so we do that through two ways. One is where we want to really be the spark of innovation. We need to facilitate research and more kind of operational research on how to deliver care. We have clinical care innovation grants. Those grants, provide funding to try a new way of delivering things. And they're a block grant. We sort of agree on the scope of it, and there's a defined population and IRB and research that comes out of it, and planning ahead to what it'll look like to scale. The second category of things that we do are what we call pilots, where there are things that there are things that have evidence that they work elsewhere, or they've worked elsewhere. It's just that we're not doing it in our region, or our provider isn't doing it. We're not paying for it in a way, and so these are, you know, things where we're looking to figure out how to do this right and optimize it over time. So just an example of a grant, for example, in the health systems we've been talking about, we had a program that actually had some attention in the Inquirer, Practical Alternatives to Hospitalization, where at Penn, where they put together a team that worked within the emergency room and identified patients that would have been admitted under normal circumstances, sort of looked into like what could we do and what do we need to set up at home or for follow-up to make sure that, you know, could this person be discharged home if only we had A, B, C, D, E in place? And they had really sort of good results, right, that were published in peer-reviewed journals showing that they could avoid a significant amount of admissions safely, have better outcomes, and have a lot of patient satisfaction. So that's a win-win-win, right? The patient and member, first of all, is the greatest winner because they get to be at home and not in the hospital, but also it's efficient in terms of cost, and it's good for a health system that's in a value-based program and that can refocus their resources for other patients that need their resources. In a pilot, for example, we've been working really closely with colleagues at Jefferson on a program around advanced illness and oncology with oncology and palliative care, really thinking about how do we help our members and their patients manage advanced illness in a way that we haven't done before. And we've done the process collaboratively and are looking to launch that soon. We that is something where, you know, there's evidence of different programs that have done it in different kinds of ways. And this is our sort of attempt at saying, hey, how would we do this at scale?
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of Managed Healthcare Executives What's on Your Mind podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.